assault route. Not far from Mount Sodom, in the motley shade of a scraggly acacia tree, are a few stone walls and the remnants of a doorway. They are the remains of a Roman fort guarding the salt route. A little 2-foot-high stone dam across the wadi, the dry riverbed, after flash floods, still holds water to be stored in the nearby Roman cistern. The other source of wealth in the area besides Mount Sodom, which was mined for salt until the 1990s, is the Dead Sea. A body of water appears so unlikely in this arid wasteland, cursed by God, that in the afternoon, when the briny sea is a cloudy turquoise mirror reflecting pink from the Jordanian mountains, the water could easily be mistaken for a mirage. Pliny wrote that the Dead Sea produces only bitumen. This natural asphalt was valued for caulking ships and led the Romans to name the sea Asphaltites Lacus, Asphalt Lake. Its water is 26% dissolved minerals, 99% of which are salts. This concentration is striking when compared to the ocean's typical mineral concentration of about 3%. The Judean Desert, the below-sea-level continuation of the Judean Hills, is a bone-white world of turrets and high walls, rising above narrow, deep canyons so pale they glow sapphire blue in the moonlight. The millions of small marine fossils embedded in the rock prove that this desert was once a seabed, whose waters dried up in the heat that is sometimes more than 110 degrees Fahrenheit. The seemingly barren desert hides life. There are said to be 200 varieties of flowers in the Judean desert, but they bloom only briefly, and only by chance does a lucky wanderer ever see one. Graceful long-horned ibex, desert mountain goats, leap over rocks. Acacia trees, which grow in the wadis, have roots that grow as deep as 200 feet and contain salt to help them draw up the water hidden underground. A shrub known as a salt bush absorbs salt from the ground into its leaves so the leaves can soak up any moisture from the air. The dry earth is actually laced with underground springs, some fresh, some brackish, which are easy to find because they are marked by small areas of vegetation. Each of these springs, Ain in Hebrew and Arab, has its own history. This desert by a sea too salty to sustain life has attracted the margins of society. They have huddled along its life-giving springs. The adventurers, the pioneers, the dreamers, the fanatics, and the zealots. Many biblical references to going off into the wilderness allude to this area. Across the Dead Sea, the barren, rocky Jordanian desert is browner. The 8-mile-wide fertile strip of the Jordan Valley's east bank feeds the nation. Israel, across the river, is the land of cell phones and four-wheel drives. Here, farmers ride on donkeys, Bedouin ride on camels, some still living in their dark wool tents, their long dark gowns elegantly furling in the desert wind. Jordanians sometimes call the Dead Sea Lot's Lake. Mohammed Nafal, a pleasant, graying government employee, explained that, according to the Quran, it was made the lowest point on earth to punish Lot's tribe for being homosexuals. But if they were all homosexuals, how can they have descendants to punish? Well, many were homosexuals. The cause of the Dead Sea's tremendous salinity has been the object of curiosity for centuries. In December 1100, after the Knights of the First Crusade made him ruler of what they termed the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, Baldwin I toured what is now the Israeli side of the Dead Sea. Fulcher of Shat, who accompanied him, observed that the sea had no outlet, and hypothesized that the source of its salt was minerals washing off of a great and high salt mountain, where the Dead Sea ended to the south, Mount Sodom. Several times in the 18th century, Dead Sea water samples were sent back to Europe for analysis. One such study was published by Antoine Laurent Lavoisier, the celebrated French chemist. A number of 19th-century American Protestant fundamentalists tried to study the Dead Sea, some through exploration and others by way of samples. Edward Hitchcock, who taught at Amherst, concluded through samples and biblical studies that the source of the sea's salt was sulfurous springs some 125 miles away. Had he visited, he would have found brackish springs much closer. In 1848, an American Navy lieutenant, W.F. Lynch, reasoning that since the Mexican-American War was over, there was nothing left for the Navy to perform, persuaded his superiors to finance his own expedition to the Dead Sea. Two boats with hulls of corrosion-resistant metals, in itself a considerable technical advance at that time, were specially designed and carried overland from the port of Haifa to the Jordan River. Lynch and his team sailed down the Jordan River to the Dead Sea, which he found to be a nauseous compound. They continued sailing south for 8 days and landed at the southern end of the sea. Lynch thought Mount Sodom to be not much of a mountain, which is true, and thought its composition to have a low percentage of salt, which is less true. Finding a broken-away column, he had a not particularly original thought, that it resembled Lot's wife. When he analyzed a sample, he discovered that it was almost pure sodium chloride, which either proved the salt content of the mountain or confirmed the identity of the salt pillar. Contemporary geologists still argue conflicting theories of why the Dead Sea is so salty. According to the most widely accepted of them, 5 million years ago the Dead Sea was connected to the Mediterranean near the current port of Haifa. A geologic shift caused the Galilee Heights to push up, and these newly formed mountains cut off the Mediterranean from the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea no longer received enough water to keep up with the rate of solar evaporation, and it began to get saltier. This theory would explain why the sea is becoming more concentrated, slowly evaporating like a huge salt pond. It is already at the density at which sodium chloride precipitates, and salt has started crystallizing out on the bottom and the edges. Bathers gingerly step over sheets of ice-like salt as they enter for a Dead Sea swim. In the early 20th century, Theodor Herzl, an Austrian visionary, began writing of the return of Jews to their homeland. In contemplating the viability of a Jewish state, he hypothesized that one of its valuable resources would be the Dead Sea, from which the new state could extract mineral wealth, including bromine and potash. In the 1920s, Moishe Novomensky, a Jewish engineer from Siberia, established the Palestine Potash Company along the northern coast of the Dead Sea in British-ruled Palestine. In 1948, when the Arab League attacked the newly formed State of Israel, the Jordanian army crossed the Jordan River and seized most of the Dead Sea area, including the Palestine Potash Company, much of the Judean desert, and the eastern side of Jerusalem. For the next 19 years, gun and rocket fire crossed the border. The Potash Company was moved to Israeli-held land in the southern Dead Sea area and renamed the Dead Sea Works. The workers of the Dead Sea Works became the first Israeli pioneers in this frontier wilderness, living in rough huts with little electricity, limited water, and no air conditioning. There, too, they were regularly shelled by Palestinians on the Jordanian side. Cut off from Jerusalem and much of Israel by the Jordanians, the Dead Sea Works found its own water wells. Today the salt works have relocated along extensive artificial ponds, and the original camp, the small houses and dining hall abandoned on a dusty plateau, is being restored as a monument to the resourceful adventurers who built Israel. In 1956, some Israeli soldiers, having finished a tour of duty at the Dead Sea, decided to stay, drawn to a freshwater spring called Ein Gedi, where a green wadi leads to a tall, thin cascade, magically tumbling water out of the desert, one of only two waterfalls in Israel that flow all year. Pliny had mentioned the spot for its remarkable fertility, though he said it had been destroyed in war with the Romans. Possessed by Herzl's Zionist dream of making the desert bloom, the Israeli soldiers founded a collective settlement in Ein Gedi, a kibbutz, where everyone worked for the profit of the community. Children were raised collectively in separate dormitories, and a paradise was to bloom on the Judean frontier. Plants were brought into a garden with lawns and tropical trees from Asia and Africa. Lychees, brilliant red flamboyance, thick, climbing, green, broad-leafed vines. Birds, spotting the rich green garden from the air, have made it a principal stop on their Europe-Africa migration. It had all been predicted in Herzl's 1902 novel, Old New Land, in which he imagines visiting the new Jewish state in 1923 and finding the Jews not only exploiting the Dead Sea's mineral wealth, but making the desert green through irrigation and living in farm collectives that exported produce to Europe. However, he also predicted that Israel would be a German-speaking nation and that Arabs would eagerly welcome Jews for the economic development they would bring to the region. The kibbutz grew, building a health spa on the shore of the Dead Sea that offered Dead Sea mud and Dead Sea water, both of which had long been supposed to have healing properties. By the late 1960s, the kibbutz had built a hotel that today is one of Israel's leading tourist attractions. In 1960, the Israelis built a hotel along another spring to the south, Ein Bokek. Since the Jordanians were to the north of Ein Gedi, the south was the only place for Israelis to develop. The Dead Sea Works had brought in water and electricity, and now the visitor could be offered the miracle that makes deserts livable: air conditioning. But the Ein Bokek development was not really on the Dead Sea. Just south of the sea, the salt company had pumped Dead Sea water into a flooded area divided by dikes. There, the brine was moved from pond to pond, ever more concentrated, until finally, the precious salt minerals fell out of the solution in the form of a white slush that was scooped up. Still, these artificial salt ponds, concentrated to a brilliant turquoise, made a stunning sea, and sand was brought in for small beaches. By 2000, Ein Bokek had 4,000 rooms in 14 hotels, all with Dead Sea health spas offering a variety of treatments, an improbable oasis of whites and pastel high-rises on the shores of a salt works. The Israelis keep building ever taller hotels, and the discreet screens used by religious people to separate women's and men's nude sunbathing on the roofs of older hotels are of little help when hundreds of guests can look down from newer hotels 10 stories above. The Israeli Defense Ministry pays for every wounded Israeli veteran, and there are many, to visit a Dead Sea spa hotel 2 times a year. Both Danish and German government health insurance will pay for a stay in an Ein Bokek spa hotel. The Israeli tourism business has in recent years begun rethinking its markets. It has not attracted Jews in the numbers hoped for. Herzl had said that attracting the Jewish diaspora would be a slow process, but after a half century as a nation, according to the Israeli Ministry of Tourism, only 17% of American Jews have ever visited Israel. Christian American tourism does better, and Germans, either seeking sunshine or health spas, are the new booming trade, Israelis report without the least note of irony. Germans are the largest national group after Israelis to visit Ein Bokek. They also comprise 1/3 of the visitors to Ein Gedi. But there is a problem. In 1985, the Ein Gedi kibbutz built a new spa on the edge of the Dead Sea. It has the atmosphere of a public beach, packed on Saturdays with Israelis lined up like crudely formed clay statues, bizarrely coated in thick black mud, baking to a gray crust in the sun. But though the spa was originally built on the water's edge, today a trolley carries bathers to the water almost a mile away. The sea recedes from Ein Gedi about 50 yards a year. In the 1st century AD, Pliny described the now 45 by 11 mile body as being 100 miles by 75 miles. A two-lane road that used to run along the sea is now several miles inland. A flat, rocky plain that was once the sea's floor leads to the water's edge. Mountains rise up against the other side of the road, and on one rock, about 10 feet above the pavement, the initials PEF are written. This is where the Palestinian Exploration Fund, a British geographic organization, marked the surface of the Dead Sea in 1917. The greatest problem of the Dead Sea is that since the Israelis built the National Water Canal from the Sea of Galilee, the Galilee has served as Israel's primary source of fresh water, greatly reducing the flow to the Jordan River, which in turn is siphoned off by Jordanian farmers in the valley, who provide 90% of Jordan's produce. Not much water is left for the dying ancient sea. Pliny called the Jordan a pleasant stream and said, "It progresses, seemingly with reluctance, toward the gloomy Dead Sea, by which it is finally swallowed." But today the stream that approaches the Dead Sea is a little rush of silted water in a reedy gully a few feet wide. Lieutenant Lynch's specially designed boats, or even a one-man rowboat, could not navigate this river to the Dead Sea. Is the Dead Sea becoming a Saharan-like Sebka, a dried bed ready for scraping? Currently the sea loses about 3 feet in depth every year. Since the northern end is in places 1,200 feet deep, it is thought that the sea has several centuries left. Another theory is that it will shrink, but reach a level of such concentration that it will no longer evaporate, which seems optimistic considering the ubiquitous dry salt beds in all of the world's major deserts. A few years ago, "dead med" became a popular phrase in Israel. The plan was to dig a waterway reconnecting the Dead Sea with the Mediterranean. This idea currently appears deader than the Dead Sea. The introduction of Mediterranean water would alter the composition of the Dead Sea, and mineral extraction would no longer be practical, thereby destroying one of Israel's most profitable industries. The Dead Sea has its health spas and tourism, but the biggest business in the area, as Herzl had predicted, is the Dead Sea Works, which has even become an international company, investing in a potash mine in Spanish Catalonia, near Cardona. The Jordanians, apparently having read their Herzl, are also counting on their Dead Sea Works. The Arab potash company is a mirror image directly across from the Israeli company. This is the Arab-Israeli border. Two sets of earthen dikes less than 3 feet high, with a cloudy turquoise Israeli evaporation pond on one side and a cloudy turquoise Jordanian pond on the other, and in between about 100 yards of white and rust and amber soil where minerals from the two ponds leach through the earthworks. Until a peace treaty was signed with Israel in 1996, the Jordanian Dead Sea region was a military zone, off limits to civilians. Now, at peace, Jordan has few resources but is full of plans. Mohammed Nufal observed with a smile, "All we need is Israel's technology, Egypt's workers, Turkey's water, and Saudi Arabia's oil. And I am sure we can build a paradise here." The Jordanians, too, are building health spas and attracting German tourists of their own. But for them also, salt will remain the leading economic activity. There are 4 Israeli pumps and 2 Jordanian pumps moving Dead Sea water into evaporation ponds. Sodium chloride, the salt of the past, is the first to precipitate out of concentrated brine. But hauling in bulk out of the Judean desert is too costly because of the lack of a waterway connection. The climb through the mountains is too steep for a railroad. The salt had to be hauled by truck until the Israelis built an 11-mile-long conveyor belt. It carries 600 to 800 tons of salt in 70 minutes to the town of Tzefa, where the land is then level enough for a railroad to the Mediterranean. This system is still too expensive for sodium chloride to be profitable. But the Israeli company sells 10% of the potassium chloride, potash, in the world, a product much in demand for fertilizers. It also produces liquid chloride and bromide for textiles and pharmaceuticals and methyl bromide, a pesticide. Under pressure because of damage to the ozone layer, it is phasing out methyl bromide production. The Jordanians say they are thinking of starting it up. The Dead Sea Works believes its future is in magnesium. Magnesium chloride, what Lieutenant W.F. Lynch called a nauseous compound, is the salt that gives the sea its bitter, unpleasant taste. It is a slightly more expensive but less corrosive alternative to sodium chloride for de-icing roads. From magnesium chloride, the Dead Sea Works also produces magnesium, a metal that is 7 times stronger than steel and lighter than aluminum. The company has invested in a joint venture with Volkswagen to make car parts. Will one more Herzl prediction come true, and Israel become German-speaking after all? Once the sodium chloride precipitates out, falling to the bottom of the pond, the principal target mineral is 6H2O-MgCl2, KCl. This grayish crystal sludge, called carnallite, fuses potassium chloride, sodium chloride, and magnesium chloride into a single crystal. The sodium chloride that precipitates out before carnallite is allowed to fall to the bottom of the pond, constantly raising the height of the pond bottoms. The company keeps building the dikes higher, but the raised ponds have been flooding hotel basements, to the great irritation of the tourism industry. The Dead Sea Works counters that its workers were the pioneers who dug the wells and provided the water and electricity that made the area usable in the first place. Tensions persist. This is, after all, the Middle East. The Dead Sea Works, recognizing the problem, has started a flood prevention program to help hotels. Common salt has become a nuisance. Chapter 23. The Last Salt Days of Qigong. In February 1912, ancient China came to an end when the last of 3 millennia of Chinese emperors abdicated. Imagine 20th century Italy coming to terms with the fall of the Roman Empire, or Egypt with the last pharaoh abdicating in 1912. For China, the following century has been a period of transition, dramatic change, and perpetual reevaluation. After 1912, the new Chinese Republic struggled economically at a time when World War I was consuming the treasuries of Europe, blocking loans that might otherwise have been available for a young and embattled government. With Western encouragement, the Chinese went back to one of the old ideas of the emperors. Salt could fill their treasury. In April 1913, the new Chinese government obtained a Western loan from the quintuple group of bankers of £25 million. The entire revenue of the Salt Administration was put up as security to repay the loan. The Salt Administration that the Republic inherited from the emperors was elaborate but extremely corrupt. In order for it to regain credibility in the eyes of Western bankers, the Chinese had to place a foreigner in charge of purging the system. An Irishman named Sir Richard Henry Dane was hired to be chief foreign inspector to the Chinese government. Amusingly, in the hindsight of history, Dane's great qualification for this post was that he had been inspector general of the salt excise in India at a time when Indian salt policy was still considered an enormous success. Dane himself freely admitted that in India, local salt had not been able to compete with Liverpool salt, but what was viewed as the important accomplishment in India was that the administration had derived enormous revenue from salt. Nicknamed the Salt King, Dane seems to have been a British colonial cliché, complete with bushy mustache, walking stick, and a reputation for big game hunting. According to a 1917 issue of the American magazine Asia, when the Chinese offered him the position, he had been about to embark on a 2-year hunting trip in the wilds of Africa. Interviewing the New Republic's new Salt King, Asia magazine described Dane as shaggy and blustering. "I suppose you Americans know nothing about Chinese salt or its administration," he began a bit testily, as he finished a scone and set down a cup of tea in his comfortable apartment in Peking. In the old administration, salt was taxed along the road from producer to consumer. To cross Hubei province, one had to pay 42 different taxes. In theory, salt production was a government monopoly, but in practice, China was too large for the government to control all salt production, trade, and transport. Instead, it merely tried to control commerce by authorizing an elite group of merchants to transport the salt from place of production and then taxing the transportation. These elite firms, known as Yuanshang, were usually family-owned and either rented out these rights or maintained them as a family monopoly from generation to generation. In Chinese folk literature, the salt smuggler is always a hero fighting the evil and corrupt salt administration. The villain of the story is often not the government, but the Yuanshang. Salt merchants amassed great wealth and liked to display it. Both Shaanxi province, north of Sichuan, and Shaanxi province, north of that and near Beijing, are famous for elegant mansions built by 17th century salt merchants. In Suzhou, a city of canals some 50 miles west of Shanghai, best known for its silk merchants, the gardens that have become one of China's leading tourist attractions were built by salt merchants. Smuggling was widespread. Dane was informed that half the salt consumed in China at the time was smuggled. The Yuanshang took advantage of the lack of a standard unit of measure to carry more salt than they reported and sell the surplus on the black market. Boatmen and cart drivers were able to bribe inspectors and make profits from smuggling. Dane estimated that 40,000 people were engaged in mostly illegal salt traffic on the Yangtze River alone, involving many thousands of square-sailed salt junks. He organized the Salt Preventive Service with salt police stations at strategic points, but this failed to stop the smuggling. In Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio, Herbert A. Giles described the smuggling he observed on a trip from Suatow to Canton in 1877. "Apropos of salt, we came across a good-sized bunker of it when stowing away our things in the space below the deck. The boatman could not resist the temptation of doing a little smuggling on the way up. At a secluded point in a bamboo-shaded bend of the river, they ran the boat alongside the bank and were instantly met by a number of suspicious-looking gentlemen with baskets, who soon relieved them of the smuggled salt and separated in different directions." Dane asserted that it is the salt revenue that has been safeguarding the credit of China. Salt has always formed one of the principal sources of government revenue, but since June 1913, when the Reform Administration was inaugurated, it has leaped into first place. Until 1915, maritime custom was the leading government revenue source. But Dane claimed that once he had reestablished a centralized salt administration in 1915, salt revenue increased over the previous year by 100%. Dane found the Chinese to be heavy salt consumers, notably higher than in India. He asserted that the Japanese were the heaviest salt consumers in the world, and that the Chinese consumed at about the same rate, which he estimated to be about 20 pounds per capita. It is probable that neither Chinese nor Japanese consumption was as high as American, but the fact that Japan would even have such a reputation was remarkable considering its unsuitability for salt production. Japan has a long and meandering coastline that would otherwise provide ideal tidal ponds and inlets for salt production, but its humid climate with regular storms and periodic flooding renders it a salt region of high cost and low production. Historically, the Japanese depended on imported salt. But in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a modernization plan under Emperor Meiji built a strong centralized economy and a modernized military. Newly empowered Japan thought it was unwise to be dependent on foreign salt. In January 1905, the Salt Monopoly Law came into force, establishing 22 salt offices around the country to regulate production, which became a state monopoly. The Japan Monopoly Office set prices and ended imports. Salt production was concentrated on the Seto Inland Sea, which, though far from ideal, was deemed the best sea salt climate in Japan because it is sheltered between two islands in a relatively southern climate. The main area, from Osaka to Hiroshima, was devastated in World War II, but the beds were restored in the 1950s. Industrialized Japan has remained self-sufficient in edible salt for products including pickles, salted fish, soy sauce, and miso. Miso is a Japanese offshoot of the Chinese import soy sauce, and like soy sauce, it is made from salt-fermented beans. Traditionally, though less so today, a Japanese meal ended with pickles, and in the North, pickles are served with afternoon tea. Japanese homes almost always had a smell of pickling, which is one reason most Japanese now prefer to buy their pickles. Among their favorite pickles are eggplants, Chinese cabbage, radish greens, and mustard greens, which are added to rice. Daikon, a root that is curiously known as either a Japanese radish or a Chinese turnip, is a staple of Buddhist monasteries, pickled in alternate layers of salt and rice bran. Dane found that the Chinese also use a great deal of salt for soaking and preserving vegetables, salting fish, pickling, and preserving meat. This was why the Chinese and Japanese were heavy consumers of salt. At the time Dane went to China, as throughout history, most Chinese salt was sea salt, pumped into evaporation ponds by windmills. However, Dane said the best salt in China is that produced from the salt wells of Sichuan. Sichuan produced about one-fifth of China's salt. Dane had arrived at the end of a golden age of Sichuan salt that had begun in the 18th century. The salt wells were mostly located around what became the city of Jigong. Between 1850 and 1877, there were 1,700 salt merchants in Jigong, and 20% of salt production was held by four families that had accumulated fabled wealth. Jigong grew along a curve of the Fuxi River, a gracefully winding tributary of the Yangtze, clogged with shallow, flat-bottomed, oar-powered boats that carried salt to much of central China. The Yangtze, the 3,700-mile waterway from the Tibetan Mountains to the port of Shanghai, the third longest river in the world, divides China into its north and south, and yet, until the 1949 communist victory, China had so little transportation infrastructure that there was not a single bridge crossing it. The Yangtze was the key transportation artery through China and its tributaries, the only connection between North and South China. By the 17th and 18th centuries, salt merchants were traveling regularly to the little provincial town of Jigong. In 1736, merchants from Shaanxi province began construction of a guild hall in Jigong for out-of-province salt traders. It took 16 years to complete this palace with roofs fanning out like wings in all directions, nimble stone dragons leaping from the edges. The courtyards were lined with red pillars, not the usual wooden pillars, but stone ones painted red. Long before the red star and red flag of communism found their chromatically perfect home in China, red was the Chinese color. The symbol of happiness. It was the color worn by a bride at her wedding. And so the salt merchants built a red palace with gilded carvings depicting Taoist legends. The guild hall, like many Chinese houses of the period, used no nails, but was held together by fitted joints. It combined the four-sided courtyard of northern architecture with the upward curved roof tips of the south. As local Chinese opera was performed on a stage on the balcony, a distinguished audience watched from the courtyard that was gardened with tall trees and elegant dwarf bonsais. Jealous of the out-of-town merchants' showy guild hall, the local salt merchants in Jigong built their own red-pillared, wing-roofed mansion, a temple with a commanding view of commerce on a high bank over the curving Fuxi, from where they could view the congested traffic of flat-bedded boats rowing cargoes of salt to the Yangtze. The well technology that had been ahead of the world in the Middle Ages continued to improve. One advance was the addition of four oxen driven in a circle, attached to a pole, which wound and released tough rope braided from bamboo leaves. The rope system was counterweighted with huge rock slabs and ran to a large wheel that served as a pulley, and then to the top of the derrick to control the bamboo tube that was dropped down for brine. The longer the tube, the higher the wooden derrick that raised and lowered it. The brine was piped to gas-heated pans in the boiling house. Then a ladle of ground yellow bean, soya, and water would be added. After about 10 minutes, a yellow scum would form on the surface and be skimmed off, ridding the salt of impurities with a simpler formula than Europeans ever found. After the brine had been boiled 5 or 6 hours to pure crystal, the salt was shoveled into a barrel and hardened. In 1835, a new well, the Shenhai Well, was drilled in Jigong. At 2,700 feet, it struck natural gas. At 2,970 feet, the well reached natural brine, but the drilling continued down to 3,300 feet, making it, at the time, the deepest drilled well in the world. 24 years later, an American would be cheered for the achievement of having drilled 69.5 feet in Titusville, Pennsylvania. The Chinese used oxen until 1902, shortly before Danes' arrival, when coal-fired steam engines were introduced. In the 19th century, the Jigong ox herd was usually about 100,000 head. Because of the oxen, in Jigong, unlike most of China, beef, albeit very tough beef, was part of the working-class diet. At the rig where they labored, salt workers would boil the tough old ox meat until it was tender, and then they would add the most common Sichuan seasoning, mala. Unique to Sichuan, ma is the spicy flavor of a wild tree peppercorn called wajiao, with a taste between peppercorn, caraway, and clove, but so strong that too much will numb the mouth. Two varieties grow in Sichuan, clay red peppercorns and the more perfumey brown ones. La means hot spice and is accomplished with small burning red peppers. The combined seasoning, ma la, defines the taste of Sichuan food. Another specialty of Jigong salt workers was wobanshi. The tough thigh of an old salt well ox was cut by hand in a continuous paper-thin slice by slowly turning the leg. Some pieces could be 2 yards long. Shang Zhenxin, managing director of Sichuan Jigong Tongsin Food Corporation in Jigong, where wobanshi is still made today, complained that it is difficult to get a leg as tough as the legs from the old working oxen, but some farm animals too old to work are satisfactory. The strips were seasoned with soy sauce and salt, then air-dried and grilled over a low heat from burning ox dung. Today a gas heater is used, but it is said that wobanshi that is cured over ox dung has a special fragrance. It is served with a vegetable oil containing hot peppers. Meanwhile, the wealthy salt merchants went for more exotic fare. In China, the more obscure the ingredients and the more arcane the method, the more status the dish has. Soaked frog was a specialty for Jigong salt merchants. A few pieces of wood would be floated in a large jar of brine. Live frogs would be put in the jar, and they would desperately perch on the pieces of wood. The jar was closed and sealed. After 6 months, the jar would be opened and the frogs would be dead and dried on the wood, but preserved because they had dipped in the salt. They would then be steamed. The salt merchants were also fond of stir-fried frog stomachs. Unfortunately, a frog's stomach, however tasty it might be, does not go a long way. It is said in Jigong that to get one serving of fried stomachs, a cook would kill 1,000 frogs. The Chinese continued percussion drilling in Jigong even after the American oil industry had developed much faster techniques. Their homegrown technology was slow but reached depths that, even in the age of petroleum, were astounding. In the 1920s, the Chinese drilled a well to 4,125 feet. And in 1966, the Shenhai Well, a record breaker in 1835, was drilled even deeper to 4,400 feet, about four-fifths of a mile. The Chinese character for Jing, meaning well, is a depiction of a Jigong derrick. The derricks, towers of gray, weather-beaten tree trunks lashed together high in the air, rigged with bamboo leaf ropes, dotted the Jigong landscape the way oil wells do in petroleum cities. In 1892, Sichuan salt makers discovered the layer of rock salt that feeds the groundwater under Jigong. Today, Jigong produces more rock salt than brine salt. But in the first few decades of the 20th century, between 300 and 400 brine wells were operating in Jigong. The beginning of the end for the ancient Sichuan salt industry came belatedly in 1943, when for the first time a rotary drill bore a well in Sichuan. It took another 20 years for the change to become apparent. In 1960, Jigong was still a backward provincial town of a third of a million people living among medieval brine derricks. That year, the last percussion-drilled shaft in Sichuan was completed. Along with modern rotary drills and rock salt mining, Sichuan salt producers were soon using vacuum evaporators, making modern white salt with crystals of a uniform size. It was in the 1960s that Jigong got its first modern public transportation. As brine boiling was fading, Sichuan engineers found a new use for the natural gas at the wells. Buses were built with giant gray bladders on the roofs, filled with the local natural gas. They started out on their routes with the huge rectangular bladder on top, almost as big as the bus. The big bladder swayed and jiggled like jello as the bus rounded corners, and then it gradually deflated, the gray bag sagging from the roof as the gas was used up. Locals call the buses Da Ki Bao, which means big bag of gas. The buses needed frequent refueling. Today, with Jigong tripled in population, the old buses are considered an embarrassing eyesore, and the remaining ones are left with the undesirable rural routes. Jigong is now a sprawling city of 1 million people, including residents of the suburbs. Stone-edged holes in the ground are all that remains of many wells. Only a few derricks are left standing in the hilly municipality, though many were not torn down until the 1990s, some as recently as 1998. Scholars struggle quixotically to save them, but these are not good times for landmark preservation in a China passionate about modernization. In 1993, two twin derricks, the symbol of Jigong, one 290 feet high and the other 284 feet high, were torn down. They were dangerously decrepit, and the government would not spend the money to repair them. They didn't understand the value that these things are only in Jigong, said Song Lengzhi, a Jigong historian. The Shenhai Well, the rugged old contraption of tree trunks and rocks, still operates. As with hundreds of wells that once pumped in Jigong, the threshold of the front gate is 2 feet high, to symbolically keep the wealth inside. The well has 10 workers who keep it operating 24 hours a day. A cable slowly lowers into the earth for several minutes and then emerges with a long, wet bamboo tube that is held over a tub by a worker who pokes the leather valve at the bottom of the tube, releasing several bucketloads of brine. The brine is still evaporated in pans heated by the gas from the well. In 1835, when the well was drilled, it had an estimated 8,500 cubic meters of gas. In the year 2000, the operators believed it had 1,000 cubic meters left. The Shuangxi Guildhall remained a guildhall until the fall of the last emperor. Then it became a local headquarters for the Chinese nationalist movement of Chiang Kai-shek. After the communists came to power, Deng Xiaoping, a native of Sichuan who became secretary general of the Chinese Communist Party, decided to make it a salt museum. Today in Jigong, there are still some crumbling, tile-roofed Chinese houses with the roof tips turned up in the southern style. But most of them are in disrepair, seemingly awaiting demolition. The new buildings seem kitschy spoofs on urban high-rise architecture. As in Beijing, historic monuments were torn down to make way for buildings that will never be completed, that remain concrete and exposed steel rods because the companies building them went bankrupt. But the Guildhall is preserved as a national monument. Of greater interest to the locals than the Guildhall is the small amount of salt still made at the Shenhai Well. They call it flat pan salt and believe it is better for pickling than the industrial salt made in vacuum evaporators. Baokai and Zhakai makers want flat pan salt for their pickled vegetables. It is sold in the Zhigong market, but outside of Zhigong, this medium-grained, untreated salt is becoming difficult to find. Shang Jianxin at the Sichuan Zhigong Tongxin Food Corporation wants flat pan salt for his Wuban Shi and other products such as Larao, a traditional Sichuan cured pork. Shang Jianxin's recipe for Larao is as follows. Cut pork into pieces any size. Cover with salt and spices, including huajiao. Leave it a week, wash off the salt, hang it 4 feet above a charcoal fire and smoke it slowly for 2 days. Add peanut shells and sugarcane trimmings to the charcoal. People at home add cypress leaves. But Shang Jianxin has trouble finding a salt that he wants to use. Vacuum salt is too fine-grained, and also they add chemical things I don't like, he said. The added chemical to which he referred is iodine, which he said has a taste that is bad for our product. Sichuan province is the size of France with twice the population. In the mid-20th century, when the Chinese population expanded at an unprecedented rate, the number of inhabitants in Sichuan grew to its current 100 million people, most of them crowded into the eastern half of the province. The west is a desert leading to Tibet. Sichuan also has a bamboo mountain forest that is home to the Earth's only remaining wild panda population. But most of the province is subtropical, like the American South. The Sichuan landscape is a tribute to the water management skills of the heirs of Li Bing, the 3rd century BC governor, with dikes and sluices breaking up waterways into a lush green quilt of flooded rice paddies, dark-soiled vegetable patches, cypress groves, and bamboo stands. Soil erosion is rare, and wasted space even rarer. But despite this rich agriculture, the farmers seem poor. They produce an enormous quantity of food, but in their villages built along the dirt trails that connect paddies and fields, there are too many people. They live in patched and crumbling mud and straw houses, a few still decorated with huge posters of Mao. Children hike miles to school along the dikes between rice paddies and up into the green mountains. Women with brightly colored parasols carry children on their backs in wicker strap-on seats that are made only in Sichuan. A frequent sight in the Sichuan countryside, one seen in Marco Polo's China, is noodles more than 7 feet long, hung out to dry like laundry on a line. Although most of the big derricks have been torn down, a few small brine wells remain. One in Dayin, west of the Sichuan capital, Chengdu, had a single post the height of a telephone pole. The well was only 1,000 feet deep, a considerable depth by any but Chinese standards, but at that relatively shallow depth, the brine was weak, only 10% salt. That was why the Chinese learned deep drilling. A farmer in a worn blue Mao jacket who grew grains, vegetables, and sweet potatoes on the land said that in the 1960s, salt had been his most profitable crop. Asked who built the well, he shrugged and said, "Oh, that well has been there forever." The blue jackets, which during the 1950s and 1960s were the only clothes available in China, along with matching pants and caps, are still commonly seen in the countryside. It is not a political statement, just people too poor for new clothes. The matching pants are seldom seen anymore. Pants wear out, but a good jacket lasts forever. Next to the pole at the Dian well, there was a stone stool. A lone farmer would sit on the stone with his feet pedaling a bamboo wheel, which would raise and lower a bamboo tube into the 1,000-foot hole. The brine was piped into a tank over which stood a much larger bamboo wheel about 10 feet tall, with bamboo cups lashed to its rim. This larger wheel was turned by a man walking carefully inside the wheel, a simpler version of the medieval wheel in Salso Maggiore. The wheel would scoop up the brine and drop it on top of a wall of dried branches. As the brine dribbled down the branches with the help of wind and sun, it would become more concentrated. After it dripped into the tank below, it was ready to be boiled for evaporation. Since this well had no natural gas, Coal, which is abundant in the area, was used for fuel. In 1998, the Government Salt Corporation sealed the well, capped the small hole in the ground with concrete, along with many other wells in the area, and ruled that such salt was substandard and illegal to sell. But there's still brine there, the farmer insisted. By the standards of Chinese history, salt producers are no longer tightly controlled. The tax is on selling, not producing, and it is no longer a major source of revenue. But the iodine requirement, the reason the little well in Dian was capped, is often seen as a new form of government control of salt. The World Health Organization and UNICEF urge salt producers to include iodine in their salt to prevent goiter, an enlargement of the thyroid gland. Since everyone uses salt, it is an ideal distribution vehicle. They claim that 1 billion people worldwide are at risk of iodine deficiency. In addition to thyroid enlargement, symptoms of iodine deficiency can include nervousness, increased and irregular heartbeat, and muscle weakness. Iodine deficiency can also lead to mental disability in children. Iodine was used to cure goiter even before it was known to be iodine. Humphrey Davy, among others, had suspected that iodine was an element, but it was Jean-Baptiste Dumas, the French chemist and founder of one of the first schools of industry in France, who in 1819 proved that iodine was present in natural sponge, which had been a standard treatment for goiter. In treating goiter, once again, China was centuries ahead of the West. A 4th century AD Chinese physician, Ko Hung, prescribed an alcoholic extract from seaweed for goiter. Many seaweeds are rich in iodine, which is why the Japanese, who not only eat a great deal of seaweed but fertilize crops with it, have had relatively little experience with the disease. In China, as in most of Asia, goiter has little history in coastal regions, but has often been problematic in mountainous interior provinces, including Sichuan. American salt is usually iodized. The British, having few cases of goiter, do not iodize, and the French sometimes, but not always, iodize their salt. Among afflicted populations, iodized salt is well appreciated. Myanmar, formerly Burma, has an iodized salt policy, but the tribesmen in the remote highlands cannot get the treated salt and instead trade illegally across the Chinese border for it. In exchange for Chinese salt, which they believe will help with their goiter problem, they offer rare, endangered wildlife species. The Chinese value these animals for folk medicine. The tongues of the antelope-like sorow are thought to cure headaches, and the nimble legs of goat-like gorals are ground into a powder used on aching joints. Rare Himalayan black bears are killed for their gallbladders, which are used to treat liver and stomach ailments. The commerce across the Myanmar border is especially tragic because much of this black market Chinese salt is in fact not iodized and so will not help them with their goiter problem. Iodized salt has become controversial in developing countries where government control of salt is a historic issue. In 1998, India followed China's 1995 decision and, under pressure from the World Health Community, banned the sale of non-iodized salt. In both countries, the move was popular with health authorities, doctors, and scientists, but very unpopular with small independent salt producers. As China became a modern state, its salt became modern salt, small uniform grains with iodine added. And like other modern people, the Chinese have started longing for salt that is a bit more irregular, perhaps less pure. Impurities are things that were left in, and many prefer this to chemicals that are added. The controversy over iodized salt is in part the distrust of chemical additives that have become part of life in virtually all cultures. In the Jewish religion, most rabbis state that salt must be non-iodized to be considered kosher for Passover. In Sichuan, wary consumers insist that iodine gives salt a peculiar taste, but small producers also suspect that the ban is a government conspiracy to put them out of business and once again give state salt companies a monopoly. peasants, such as the family at the little foot-operated well that was capped in rural Dayin, do not have the knowledge or money to meet government standards for iodized salt. In September 2000, the Indian government repealed its ban on non-iodized salt under pressure from Hindu nationalists and Gandhians, who recalled Gandhi's assertion that every Indian had a right to make salt. But the Chinese authority did not seem inclined to go back on its decision to ban non-iodized salt. Li Fude of the Government Salt Agency for Sichuan Province, the General Sichuan Salt Company, said, "It was decreed by the Prime Minister himself." He said it like an ancient bureaucrat, speaking of the emperor. Chapter 24. Ma, La, and Mao. The Chinese have been slow to part not only with their emperors, but with many ancient ideas. Among the lingering old ways in modern China are attitudes about food, about salt and seasoning, and how to construct a meal. Many of these ideas, though notably different from current Western thought, did exist in the pre-Renaissance West. The differences between China and the West on food are far greater today than 1,000 years ago. The Chinese seem ready to eat anywhere and anytime. City streets and rural roads are lined with food stalls. On the Trans-Siberian Railroad that runs from Moscow to Beijing, the heater at the end of cars that the Russians use to make tea is used by the Chinese to prepare whole meals. They crowd into the dark, closet-like space and chop vegetables and spread out seasonings. Not only do they cook and eat constantly, but they talk a great deal about the meaning of their foods. Food sometimes seems a Chinese obsession, and the culture at times seems almost afflicted with Epicurism. The contemporary Chinese novelist Lu Wenfu wrote, "The word gourmet is pleasing to the ear, perhaps also to the eye. If you explain it in a simple everyday language, however, it's not so appealing. A gourmet is a person who is totally devoted to eating." Lu Wenfu, The Gourmet, 1979. In China, southern food, especially Cantonese, is usually said to be the best. But after 1949, when Mao Zedong from Hunan and Deng Xiaoping from Sichuan came to power, the hot spicy food, La, from southwestern China, came into official fashion. "If you don't eat La, you are not a revolutionary," became a popular saying. In 1959, a restaurant for the political elite was established in a Beijing house of gardened courtyards, built for the son of a 17th century emperor. Predictably, it was a Sichuan restaurant, and was simply named the Sichuan Restaurant. Zhou Enlai, the longtime premier, and Deng Xiaoping were regulars. For years, it was considered one of the few good restaurants in communist Beijing. The restaurant remained a symbol of the times when, in 1996, its antique setting was bought by a Hong Kong entrepreneur who turned the house into a private, members-only club with the obsequious, gentlemanly service reminiscent of British colonialism. The so-called Chinese takeover of Hong Kong has, in fact, meant that many Communist Party relics have been bought up by Hong Kong entrepreneurs. The Sichuan restaurant has survived in three less sumptuous Beijing locations. Its head chef, Yu Jiamin, is a native of Beijing who in 1970, at age 19, began apprenticing in Sichuan cuisine. "For me, it is the most complete cuisine, the only one that completely uses six flavors," he said. The notion of balancing principal flavors is central to Chinese cooking. The six of Sichuan food are expressed as a musical jingle. Ma, La, Tian, Suan, Xian,